Mental illness is epidemic in America, and the problem is spreading worldwide. It's time for decisive action, because the battle for the mind is part of a much larger war being waged between good and evil, with you as the prize. Welcome to Simple Solutions with Christian psychiatrist and author Dr. Timothy Jennings. For the next hour, we'll uncover Bible-based weapons for fighting destructive feelings and resolving inner conflicts. Dr. Jennings wants to arm you with the tools necessary for achieving emotional and mental stability as you strengthen your relationship with God. We'll open the phone lines for your questions in just a moment. I'm your Simple Solutions host, Charles Mills.
Today we're going to talk about psychiatric medications. Do you have any questions on this topic? Some people struggle with taking meds, thinking that faith should be enough. But sometimes faith isn't enough. But there are dangers with meds. What's a patient to do? Let's talk with Dr. Jennings about medications and faith, how to come to appreciate the power and benefit of both. Dr. Jennings, let's just start off with a question to you. What's your take on this subject?
Well, my take is that we live minimum 6,000 years since God created Adam in the Garden of Eden, and many, many biologic defects, genetic defects, have entered the human gene pool. One estimation is that we have over 1 million pieces of DNA, foreign pieces of DNA, non-human DNA, in our human DNA.
Wow.
That have entered over the course of the year since the fall, which has contributed to all types of problems and defects in our biology. To the degree that we can intervene with science to reverse or accommodate or somehow move us physiologically back toward our original design, then the better we can be. So I am very open to science and using the wisdom that God gives us to apply that in appropriate ways to bring healing to people. And that is ultimately the goal. So our faith doesn't, at this point in human history, reverse the physiologic damage that sin is doing to our human organism. In time, our faith will one day lead to a new heaven and a new earth, will one day lead us to participate with God in a new heaven and a new earth, and we will experience a new physiology. But until that time, we want to use our best judgment as God enlightens us to make healthy decisions in lifestyle, but also in medical interventions to bring healing as we're able.
Now, Dr. Jennings, if we compare Adam and Eve to, you know, Joe and Sandra, okay, they're standing here in this garden, Joe and Sandra are standing in a Collegedale garden, and Adam and Eve standing in the Garden of Eden. Yes, there's a 6,000 years that separate them, and yes, there's 6,000 years of degradation brought on by sin, but hasn't the Creator been able to keep up with those degradations by using what He created originally to help us along the way? Has He not been able to make foods and the air and the waters and the sunshine more powerful for us to overcome these things as opposed to sitting there taking medications all the time?
I'm completely confused by that question.
Yeah,
Some people say
that, you know, we can't get the nutrition that we had before from our foods because our foods have been around for 6,000 years and they're not as nutritious as they were in the Garden of Eden.
That's true.
Well, that's only about 15% true. According to studies, our food is about 15% less nutritious than it was 100 years ago, which means, you know, instead of eating three broccoli,
Wait a minute. What scientific evidence do you have that food is 15% less nutritious than it was in Eden?
I'll have to ask Dr. Michael Greger about that. A guest we had about 3 weeks ago on this program who found that study and discovered that that's what he said, 15%. So there's a 15% difference.
No. He has no evidence of the nutritional aspect of food in the Garden of Eden. I'd like to see what evidence he has.
Okay, all right. He's talking about 100 years ago, 100 years ago.
100 years ago, we've already degraded 5,000 years. Yeah, so basically, if you go by that study, then in 100 years, we've lost 15%. So in 6,000 years, what kind of percentage have we lost?
Yeah.
If you're using 15% every 100 years, we're basically not even eating anything but cardboard.
But my question is, did God just leave us to spiral out of control? Did God not make accommodation for the degradation that's taking place in us with His natural foods and laws that He put in place in garden along with us?
His accommodation was not through fixing nature at this point in time. In fact, what scriptures tell us is that this world is a theater, a spectacle to angels and to men, and two antagonistic principles are being played out in this world. And Romans 8 tells us that all nature groans under the weight of sin. So nature itself is harmed by sin. So no, that we can't look into the natural world and find a super element that God has introduced to counteract the physiological effects of sin on our being. No, that's not there. That didn't happen. What counteracts the weight of sin is Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ came to undo what sin has done to the human species. And he has done that in his person and now offers us a healing of character and mind. And one day, God's supernatural presence and power will regenerate all things back as they were. But where we live now, we live in a world that's still shielded or veiled from God's full presence and therefore is deteriorating slowly over time through all aspects of nature. So people who would argue that somewhere in nature is the ultimate healing for our situation are arguing a false construct, in my opinion.
So you're saying that God's accommodation for the degradation of sin is drugs?
I didn't say that either. I said God's accommodation for the degradation of sin is Jesus Christ. But while we're still waiting in this planet, we are to use the God-given wisdom that he has given us to do all we can in harmony with the laws that he has created this world to operate upon. Now, the human body is a complex machine. And as we can understand the principles that this machine is designed to operate upon and use the scientific principles he's given us to make that machine run more efficiently, then it is very godly and wise to do so. And medication can help participate in that process.
Okay, so God teaches us to create these drugs, these very powerful drugs, to work in harmony with his laws.
I didn't say that either.
Well,
I didn't say that.
What are you saying
to
us? I'm looking for the truth here.
Well, why don't we talk about how the medications work, since that's what the show is to be about today. These questions really are more of a philosophical in nature, and God gives wisdom to all people, but there are people out there that are manufacturing drugs for the purpose of just getting money and being greedy, and God's not involved in that, okay?
Now we're talking.
No, we're not talking, because that is not the purpose that all drugs are made. Some people are making medications, and these black and white arguments to make it either one way or the other is a false dichotomy. Medications can be beneficial. They can be harmful. We have to use our wisdom and judgment. Some people are making them altruistically. Some people are making them because of greed and personal gain. There are lots of motivations, because we live in a world in which there are two antagonistic principles. And to try to break everything down into either one or the other really creates false dichotomies in people's mind. And we are to have the wisdom to be able to discern the differences and apply those differences and apply the right because it is right. And so let's instead try to educate our audience today about how some of these medications work and why they can be beneficial.
Let's do that. That sounds like an excellent plan. All right, we'll follow you. Take us through this thing. How do they work and why are they important to us?
Well, and one of the things we need to understand a little bit is about how the brain works a little bit and what's gone wrong in our brain and our physiology. And we can talk about different neural circuits, and we can talk also about, on the cellular level, the neurons themselves. A neuron is a brain cell, and as one brain cell communicates to another, the way they communicate is they communicate through a little tiny gap called a synapse by releasing a chemical that the neuron makes to signal the adjoining or adjacent neuron to it, sending a signal across this little tiny gap, a chemical signal. Now, these neurons actually, in order to send the chemical signal, have to produce the chemical internal to themselves first. And different neurons produce different types of chemicals. And most of our audience have probably heard of some of these things. Have you heard of serotonin?
Yes,
absolutely. Have you heard of dopamine? Have you heard of norepinephrine or noradrenaline?
Well, melatonin, too.
Yeah, these are three of the big neurotransmitters that antidepressant and antipsychotic medicines are trying to modulate in some way. Now, different cells produce these. In other words, one cell will produce serotonin, one set of cells, a different cell will produce norepinephrine, a different cell will produce dopamine. Well, we can take certain nutrients, for instance, the metabolized version of folic acid called L-methylfolate, and we get folic acid in foods, but the metabolized version of folic acid is a required cofactor for the neurons to make these various neurotransmitters we just talked about, serotonin, dopamine, and norepinephrine. So if we're deficient in this, then the machinery of the brain itself doesn't make a plentiful amount of the various neurotransmitters to signal back and forth. It just so happens it's about 7 out of 10 people with major depression have a genetic mutation that impairs their ability to metabolize dietary folic acid into its metabolized form, L-methylfolate. And therefore, even if they're getting it in foods, they're not getting it to the brain because only the metabolized version crosses the blood-brain barrier. So here's one place the machinery may not be working. The machinery may not be working because we're not giving it the proper cofactor it needs in order to make these various things. Well, there are products out there, pharmaceuticals, which give us in the pill form L-methylfolate, which is the metabolized version of folic acid. So we can take that, crosses the blood-brain barrier, it's a cofactor. Now the machinery of the brain can, if that's the problem for this particular person, start producing adequate amounts of the various neurotransmitter in the particular patient. So this is one place we can intervene in the machinery, providing the cofactor that wouldn't have been provided because of a genetic mutation that occurred because of the fall.
Why aren't we all that way? Why do you say 7 out of 10? What's the other 3? What do they not have that the other 7 have?
Well, this is only one place where the machinery of the neural circuit can break down. After the internal to the cell and the cytoplasm of the cell, as the cells make the various serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine, there is an enzyme inside the cells that will break down excesses. So if for some reason there's being too much, it's flowing into the cytoplasm, there's an enzyme called monoamine oxidase. And this enzyme will break down these various monoamines to keep excesses from breaking up. This enzyme happens to be located both inside and outside the cell. So when cells release these neurotransmitters to keep excesses from building up, there's an enzyme there to break it down. Well, we have medications that can inhibit or can stop these enzymes from working. These are antidepressant medications called monoamine oxidase inhibitors. And they inhibit these various enzymes from breaking it down, which significantly increases the amount of these neurotransmitters being released. These medications called monoamine oxidase inhibitors are actually fairly old. They've been around for 40 years or more. And they're also fairly dangerous because these enzymes protect us from overloads. And if you get overloads of these medicines, you can get hypertensive crisis where your blood pressure shoots up really, really high and you can experience stroke and heart attack. So these particular older medicines, the monoamine oxidase inhibitors, are also dangerous.
All right. Well, we're going to talk more about this. This is very important stuff because, you know, we want to be able to have a clarity of thought. We want to somehow be able to overcome that 6,000 years of sin that we've experienced. And Dr. Jennings today is showing us how we can do that. This is exciting stuff. So everybody stay right where you are.
Here's your Daily Heartbeat with Dr. James Markham.
One of the neat things about the Bible is it gives you millions, well, tons of ways to change your body's chemistry. Did you know that the Bible is filled with wonderful ways that we can change our chemistry? Now, would you rather take a prescription medication or do something from the Bible to help you feel better? I would choose to follow the owner's manual. This is the way we can best get our chemistry the way God intended. If you jumped off a building, things would break. Likewise, if we don't follow the laws God's given us, our chemistry changes. We're not following the owner's manual. When this happens day in and day out, we become diseased and sick. So in Heartbeat, I want us to follow the biblical prescriptions to change our chemistry.
Thank you, Dr. Markham. If you'd like more information, go to HeartWiseMinistries.org. That's HeartWiseMinistries.org.
Like to ask you if you enjoy stories.
You do? That's great, because we're here to tell you how you can get some free cassettes with dramatized stories on the life of Jesus.
That's right, David.
You call Life Talk Radio at 800-775-4673 and enroll in the Adventures in the Holy Bible Studies.
And it doesn't matter if you're 9 to 99 or somewhere in between.
They'll send a set of lessons to you with neat activities that will help you study the Bible. Every time you finish 4 studies with your next set, they'll send you a free cassette tape with 2 dramatized stories on it.
That's cool! What's that number again?
800-775-4673.
David and I love listening to these tapes. What's that phone number one more time?
800-775-4673.
Welcome back to Simple Solutions with Christian psychiatrist and author Dr. Timothy Jennings. I'm your host, Charles Mills. There's a point in the movie The Wizard of Oz where Dorothy says to Toto, "We're not in Kansas anymore." You know, Dr. Jennings, as I hear you talk about this, we're not in Eden anymore by any far shot, are we?
We are far, far from it. But the good news for the for humanity is that God's plan is to restore us all back, to fix
Amen.
All the biological defects, all the mental defects, all the relational defects, all the character defects. One day we are going to be fully restored.
Well, we are going to do what we have to do until then, and you're helping us now figure out how to keep our brains intact, how to keep the information flowing, and how to keep our brains healthy as we live in this very degraded, not in Kansas anymore society. Continue that discussion. That sounds good, Dr. Jennings.
Let's just back up and just give a little overview for our audience. Obviously, the first place to start is to live our lives as best we can in harmony with the way God designed our lives to be lived. So we want to, live healthfully. We want to eat healthy foods. We want to avoid toxins. We want to get good sleep. We want to have healthy relationships, avoid conflict, try to minimize stress, have a healthy spirituality and relationship with God. All these things actually help keep the system healthy. In America, modern Western society is actually toxic to our brain.
Yes, it really is.
It's toxic to our brain. We live high stress. We put substances in. The fast food diet causes inflammation. The television watching, certain forms of music, so many things we do. The breakdown of the close-knit family and community, all these things that have happened, including evolutionary thinking and the breakdown of a faith-based system in God, has all led to the marked rise in mental illness in the late 20th and early 21st century than we've probably ever seen. Not to say there hasn't been mental illness throughout society for as long as we've kept human history. We have in the Bible David struggling with depression himself. But things are getting much worse. Our society is really, really stressful, which leads to the inflammatory cascade, which breaks down the circuits and the system, leading to greater mental illness problems.
We had Cain killing Abel in the shadow of the Garden of Eden walls.
That's
how fast it happened.
That wasn't really mental illness, though. That was simple
murder.
That was selfishness and jealousy. That wasn't a neurophysiological breakdown.
Okay, all right, I see what you mean. Okay,
okay.
All right, okay.
That was just selfishness rather than love acting out.
Yeah, that's true.
But what have happened in the aftermath of that would have led to guilt, and that guilt that he would experience would have led to consequences on a neurophysiological level. Okay. Anyway, so as we now talk about normal physiology, just walk the audience again through, when one neuron talks to another neuron, it releases chemical into a tiny little gap called a synapse. That chemical will stimulate receptors on the receiving cell, which will then internal to that cell send a second wave of messengers down to the DNA of the receiving cell and will actually alter or change how certain genes are being expressed. This is part of normal neuron function. The neuron that releases the neurochemical has on it receptors that register the rise of the very chemical that's being released. As that rise is registered, it signals the cell that is releasing, saying, "Hey, you've released enough. We've got plenty out here now. Concentrations are just right. You don't need to release anymore." It's called an autoreceptor, telling the neuron you don't need to release anymore. Well, another place that we can intervene with medication is by blocking those autoreceptors. And by blocking those autoreceptors, it would be like cutting the brake cables on your car. You see, when you cut the brake cables, you can't slow down. The medicines that block these will prevent the neurons from slowing down release or stopping release after they've already released what would typically have been the threshold to stop. So we can intervene, as we mentioned earlier, by giving nutrients that help the neurons make more of the neurotransmitters. We can intervene by blocking the enzymes that break them down. We can intervene with medications to block the autoreceptors, the braking system, so they don't break. But the releasing neuron also, and by the way, the medicines that do that, a medicine that blocks the autoreceptor, there, medicine called Remeron or mirtazapine is an antidepressant, and that's how it works. By blocking autoreceptors, that will result in increasing release of serotonin and norepinephrine. That's primarily the action of that. There are also medicines that are used, if you've seen advertisements recently, for certain medicines like atypical antipsychotics, quetiapine, also known as Seroquel, or aripiprazole, also known as Abilify. In the augmentation of depression, one of the ways they work is they also antagonize autoreceptors on the dopamine neurons so that they cause more dopamine to be released. So this is one of the ways they work. So we can understand the machinery of the brain, and we can intervene in these areas. Another place, the releasing neuron has little vacuum cleaners on it called reuptake pumps that when they release the neurotransmitter into the synapse, it sucks it back up to repackage and reuse again very efficiently. We can use medicines to turn off or block those reuptake transporters or reuptake pumps, those little vacuum cleaners. Medicines like Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, Effexor, Cymbalta, Lexapro, Celexa, the SSRIs, the SNRIs, even the tricyclic antidepressants like Elavil and Pamelor and Nortriptyline, these types of medicines, these older ones, all of these medicines work on these reuptake pumps. If it's an SSRI, that means selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. So it's blocking just the vacuum cleaners on or the serotonin reuptake pumps on the serotonin circuits. If it's an SNRI, serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor, it blocks both vacuum cleaners. That would be Cymbalta, and Effexor would be the primary two, and the tricyclic antidepressants, the older ones. They block both of those reuptake pumps. And so in doing that, it keeps the neurotransmitter in the synaptic space longer, signaling the postsynaptic circuit longer.
Okay, all right. Now, I want to just interject in here. Are what you're talking about, these medicines you're talking about, who sound amazing, I mean, they're doing amazing things, are these something you are looking at as a temporary bridge to help someone heal, or do they actually heal?
This is a great question. And there's actually, if I can maybe give one more example, postsynaptically, when we increase the neurotransmitters in the synaptic space, we stimulate postsynaptic receptors. Well, we also have medicines which will directly stimulate those postsynaptic receptors, acting as if it is the neurotransmitter itself. And there's several medicines that will do that. Some of the atypical antipsychotics like aripiprazole or Abilify and Seroquel quetiapine directly stimulate postsynaptic receptors, acting as if it is the antidepressant itself. Now, let's go back to your question. When we give an antidepressant, how long would you guess, I know you're not medical, you're not trained, how long would you guess from the time they take the very first antidepressant medicine until we actually increase the amount of neurotransmitters available in the synaptic space? Hours, days, weeks, or months?
One week.
That's a good guess. And a lot of people guess that because if we ask the question, if somebody's depressed and we give them an antidepressant, how long till we generally start seeing them improving? Within hours of the first dose, week, couple of weeks, sometimes a month. Generally, it's weeks to months before we see improvement. Yet, interestingly enough, it's only within a matter of an hour to 2 hours from the first dose that we're already increasing these neurotransmitters in the synaptic spaces of the brain. One of the theories out there has been, and people have probably heard doctors even tell them, you've got a serotonin deficiency, or you've got a norepinephrine deficiency, or you've got low serotonin in your brain. Well, when you take your first antidepressant, we will increase serotonin availability within hours of the first dose. Yet depression doesn't clear for weeks, usually week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. Why? Because the real problem is not actually simple lack of availability of neurotransmitters. The real problem in depression is actually alteration in cell function. Cell function in both the neurons and the white cells of the brain are not functioning normally anymore. And we can't get down into the control center of the neuron directly with our medicine and instruct the DNA, the nucleus of the cell, with new instructions on how to alter its protein production and turning on certain genes and turning off certain genes. We can't directly with our medicines go right to the DNA at this point in time. So what we have discovered instead is our antidepressant medicines, through all these other mechanisms I just told you about, activate second messengers within the cells, and those second messengers go actually to the DNA and will alter which genes are turned on and which genes are turned off, which results in alteration in cell function. New instructions are coming out of the DNA to make new proteins, turn other proteins off. This changes both white cells and neurons of the brain, and this is what actually gives us the benefit that we're looking for.
It's like the cells have created or have generated bad habits themselves. Is that how you would say it?
That's an interesting way of putting it, because what happens is the choices we make in life, everything, the day-to-day experience, it's not just the choices we make. Life happens to us without even making a choice sometimes, but experience, environment will alter which genes are turned on and which genes are turned off, which can contribute to developing depression. So it's not just the genes. If you consider the DNA that you have as a great library of information, and you think about a library, all those books are up there. And depending on which books are being accessed, from the data in the books, you can then produce, let's say they're all recipe books. Let's say they're all cookbooks, okay? So you open up a cookbook to a different particular recipe. If that's the recipe that's open, then you're producing a particular food product, a particular outcome. Well, our DNA is a library of recipes, of proteins and all types of things. And depending on which books we open, then we produce different substances. Well, life experience is constantly altering which genes are being expressed and which genes are not being expressed. If we have high stress in our life, it will activate the immune system, which will cause inflammatory factors to cross the blood-brain barrier, which will cause cellular changes in our brain and DNA instruction changes. And the antidepressants will actually, through these mechanisms I've described, send a new set of instructions to the DNA to turn on certain genes that have been turned off by high stress in life.
Okay. All right. Are we talking about like a stent? Follow me here. Doctors put in a stent to get blood flowing again, but the stent doesn't cure the heart disease. The stent keeps you alive so that you can cure the heart disease with other things that you do in your life. Is this the same thing that's happening here with these medications?
Well, let's pick that up and discuss more about that after the break.
All right, let's do that. Let's find out what Dr. Jennings has to say about that. Our phone lines are open for your questions and comments. 800-775-4673. 800-775-4673. We'd love to hear from you, and you can ask your question directly to Dr. Jennings. 800-775-4673.
And now, a parable big change moment.
One of the things that all of us have in common is our ability to deceive ourselves. Now, what do I mean by that? To deceive ourselves means that basically we can talk ourselves into just about anything. Essentially, once I've made up my mind that I want to buy something, once I've made up my mind that I want to do something, I can pretty much talk myself into anything. And I have a feeling you're the same way. That's called the art of self-deception. And did you know there is one single question that if you were to ask it of every opportunity, every invitation, and every financial decision, this one simple question has the ability to free you from your tendency to deceive yourself. And here's the question. What is the wise thing to do? Wisdom penetrates self-deception. And one of the best things you could do is to begin to ask yourself that question every time you make a decision. What is the wise thing to do?
A parable big change moment with Andy Stanley from his book, Up to You. Parable.com.
I'm sick of this. I'm sick of dealing with you. I'm sick of...
I work 6 days a week. Who do you think you
are?
Don't you ever talk back to me again! You just shut up!
What a child learns about violence.
What are you crying about, little brat?
A child learns for life.
We have suspects from earlier assault in custody. Male, 15 years of age.
Teach carefully. We're ACT, Adults and Children Together, Against Violence. And if you're a parent or caregiver, we can help you teach your child how to rise above violence, not succumb to it. Visit actagainstviolence.org for details or call 877-ACT-WISE for a free brochure. Call today, 877-ACT-WISE, and stop violence before it starts. This message brought to you by the Ad Council, the American Psychological Association, and the National Association for the Education of Young Children.
Jesus said in John 14:27, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give you. Do not let your hearts be troubled, and do not be afraid." Do you long for that peace in your life? Let's return to Simple Solutions with Christian psychiatrist and author, Dr. Timothy Jennings.
Welcome back to the program. I'm your host, Charles Mills, with Dr. Jennings here. We're talking about psychiatric medications today, and we have a mostly Christian audience here on the Life Talk Radio Network, and I'm so glad for each and every one of you. And I know that many of you have questions about this, as well as how faith involves in there. So we're going to talk about these things during this half hour. We also want to make sure that you have an opportunity to share your questions and comments on the topic. That's why our phone lines are open, 800-775-4673 is our phone number, so we'd love for you to call in and just join us, 800-775-4673. Dr. Jennings, you have outlined some very amazing medications that science has developed that is used in helping depressed people. And I asked you before the break, are these medications sort of like a stent? A cardiologist will put a stent in a blocked artery to increase blood flow, but everyone knows that stent does not take care of the problem that brought about the closure to begin with. It keeps you alive so that you can address the problems that brought the necessity for the stent. Is the same thing happening with these drugs?
Not exactly. What I would suggest is you said the drugs are amazing. What's amazing is the brain and God's design for the brain. That's what's amazing.
Yes,
The drugs, they're just taking advantage of God's design and trying to.
Oh, I like that.
And trying to intervene to return a balance that has gotten out of balance. Now,
I like that.
All those mechanisms that we went through earlier in the show, which I'm not going to repeat right now, all of them are genetically determined, which means that gene defects can affect all of them. We can have gene defects that cause an enzyme to be hyperactive or hypoactive. In other words, it doesn't work as well or works too well. In fact, that has been documented with a simple one single point mutation in an enzyme that breaks down dopamine in the dopamine circuits in the synaptic spaces. If you have this particular mutation, then you have an enzyme that is heat sensitive. So at body temperature, it does not work as well, which means that you have more dopamine available in the front part of your brain, which means that you have better memory and concentration than people who have the efficient version. So people with a super efficient version of the enzyme break down dopamine so bad they don't attend and focus and remember as well. So medicines can augment by blocking the reuptake pump or blocking this enzyme so that you keep dopamine out there so you have better memory, attention, focus. And so every point along the way that we've described a place in medicine acts is also a point where genes can have a defect that cause things not to work right.
And so we have to look at ourselves as defective, and we have to look for these medications to help us in this, again, temporary or permanent. Can we fix the problem?
Next question is, it's not just the genes you have. Now, I just gave an example of a mutation. Mutation is an actual change in the code of the gene.
And you can't change that back?
No, not here at this time.
Okay.
But much of what mental illness is not actually a defect in the code itself, but a change in the way the genes are being expressed. Which gene is being turned on and which gene is being turned off? That can be altered by time and experience. Some of the changes, however, are harder to reverse, the expression changes, than others. So because of the, I won't go into the chemistry of it, but some chemical groups that will lock down the DNA and turn it off are much more tightly bound than other groups are, so it's harder to reverse or get those groups off and unlock that again once it's locked down. That actually is one of the reasons why people have had recurrent episodes of depression generally cannot go off of medication, because the recurrent episodes of depression have caused cellular change and subcellular change that is even though theoretically reversible, it is generally not functionally reversible over the course of the lifetime. And so they need to stay on meds.
If we follow along with your illustration of the library of recipes, the DNA being a library of recipes, some of those recipes are damaged. Some of those recipes are mutated. They're wrong. So if you choose that recipe, you're going to have a problem. If you choose another recipe, you wouldn't have a problem.
Well, that's true. That is true. And actually, I told you there are estimated a million pieces of DNA that are not even human in the human gene pool. And how we avoid much of the negative consequence of that is that the DNA, that this foreign DNA, is being shut down. It has what's called methyl caps that lock it down, and so even though it's there, it's not being expressed. So some of this defective DNA is shut down. That's possible. What I was actually talking about, you have the right DNA, you want it expressed, you have the right recipe, things have happened to put a lock over that section of the library. These books are unavailable now.
Okay.
Right. And what happens is with our medications go in and unlock that section of the library where we can now have access to those recipes, and things start being produced again that weren't being produced but should have been produced. What happens without the meds is that the locks lock things back down again for many people. Right. And so they have to stay on their meds for quite some time. But we talked about antidepressants. Maybe we should talk a little bit about antipsychotic medications, medicines used in conditions like bipolar disorder, which can be antipsychotics as well as mood stabilizers, and medicines used in conditions like schizophrenia. In order to do that, we need to talk about a little different circuit. Let's talk about dopamine just for a minute. And there are three primary dopamine pathways I want to talk about. One is a pathway that's involved in muscle or motor movement. They don't need to remember the name, but the name is nigrostriatal. But just think of Parkinson's disease. If you ever known somebody with known of someone with Parkinson's disease, they have alterations in the way their muscles work. They don't move correctly anymore. They have tremor. They're rigid and stiff. They're slow. Their face doesn't express the same way. Why? Because this particular pathway in the brain that operates on a neurotransmitter called dopamine has had the neurons that produce the dopamine dying. They're losing those neurons. And because those neurons are dying, they don't have the dopamine there, and then we get all this motor muscle difficulty, motor movement difficulty. Medicines for Parkinson's disease ultimately are doing something to increase the dopamine signal, either by causing dopamine to be released, by acting or pretending like dopamine, the medicine itself stimulating the dopamine receptor, pretending like it's dopamine. It's some way to try to make a dopamine signal in that circuit to make motor movement better. And there's multiple mechanisms to make that happen. I tell you that because we can cause Parkinson-like symptoms by blocking dopamine in that particular circuit. If we put medicines in the way and block it, then it would be the functionally the same as not having it there. It's not we're doing its job anymore. And so people can get stiff and rigid and tremulous and have motor symptoms when they're on medicines that block dopamine. And that's one of the side effects of taking antipsychotic medications. Antipsychotic medications block dopamine primarily, one of their main functions. And that's because there's another pathway. The second of the three pathways is called mesolimbic. This pathway, when we have too much dopamine in this pathway, it causes, because of excess dopamine, we will get paranoid, we will get irritable, we'll get aggressive, we'll even hear things or potentially see things, hallucinate, because the system is being overstimulated by too much dopamine. Therefore, antipsychotic medications will block dopamine in this particular circuitry, reducing the intensity of the signal, taking away what's called psychotic symptoms. And then the final circuit is the one goes to the part of your brain right behind your forehead called the prefrontal cortex. And if we have too little dopamine here, then we have what's called negative symptoms, where we have no energy, we have no expression, we have no motivation, we have sluggishness of thoughts, we lose our creativity, we're kind of blah, bland, and apathetic, and listless, basically. Not depressed, though, just kind of like the lights are on, but nobody's home. Kind of thing.
Okay.
And some of the medications that increase dopamine in this part of the brain help people become more back to themselves, where they have a little life to themselves again. But if we block dopamine in this part of the brain, then we can cause a zombie-like state. People aren't depressed, but they're zombie-like. some of the antipsychotic medications that are trying to reduce dopamine in that limbic system, so we take away hallucinations, can block dopamine in the other two pathways as well, and therefore can cause either rigidness or stiffness, or can cause zombie-like states. That was particularly true of the older antipsychotics like Haldol and medicines like that. That was one of the main drawbacks to those older medications. Some of the newer medications that are used today have less of a risk of these two problems, but sadly, they have a whole new set of risks, which are obesity and diabetes and things like that.
My. Now, you say risks. We're talking about side effects. These are things that we need to really talk about. I'm sure as a physician and as a psychiatrist, Dr. Jennings, you have to weigh benefit and risk in each one of these things, right?
We weigh, and then we communicate that risk to the patient, and the patient and the family has to weigh, and they ultimately make the decision, if they have the capacity to make decision, on whether they will take the medicine or not take the medicine. And you have to understand, though, a lot of people think, oh, let's talk about, I'm depressed. Well, antidepressants have risks. They can cause this. They could do this. They could do the other. Well, I don't want to take that risk. What people forget, however, is untreated mental illness has risks. Yeah. And has consequence. Yes. And if you don't treat it, you're damaging neural circuits. You're losing neurons. Not only that, if you don't treat it, some people are concerned, well, what if I'm pregnant and I take a medicine like this? It has risks to what's happening to my child. That's true. It does. Mm-hmm. But guess what? Untreated mental illness has risk and alters the developing brain of a child as well.
Really?
Yes, it
really
does.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Wow. So we have to weigh those risks out. It's not like I get risks here and I have none there. There are risks on both sides of the equation.
In your experience, can you give me a percentage of people who said, yes, it's worth the risk to take these medications? Is it 50%, 75%?
A percentage of...
Of people who decide to go with the medications. Even though they have risks.
In my experience, in the patients who are coming to see me, now I'm not seeing everybody in the world. I would suggest that people who are averse to medication don't come see me. So in the population that come to my office, it's 99.9% of them are taking medication or willing to take medication if it's needed. Let's put it that way. It's not that they're all on it because all of them don't need meds because some conditions don't need medications. But those who need it essentially are all willing because that's why they're coming. Those who are averse generally don't come see a psychiatrist.
Okay. All right. This is a song and dance here because we've got to figure out, you know, how much God can use the drugs, how much God can use the medicine, and as Christians, and most of our audience listening to this program right now today are Christians, and that's why I asked the questions I asked you, Dr. Jennings. Most of us are Christians, and we think, you know, if we just had enough faith, if we just deepened our relationship with God, then we would not be so depressed, we would not be so unhappy, we would not be so angry at the world if we just got right with God. What's wrong with that thinking?
There's nothing wrong with that thinking if it's not extremist. Because there's truth, but the problem is with some truths, if you take them to extremes, they can become harmful. You can say, you know, if we just maintained our hydration, if we didn't get dehydrated, we wouldn't have some, you know, kidney problems, and we could think clear, because dehydration affects brain and increased risk of heart attacks because the blood becomes thicker and more coagulable. So if we just stay hydrated, we'd be healthier. All true. But if you overhydrate, you can kill yourself with water intoxication.
That's true.
Okay, so anything we go to extremes on, we can actually cause problems with, and that's what we want to avoid.
Can we say then, Dr. Jennings, to our Christian audience, that this is a personal thing and that God wants to be a part of this and God can lead in these areas? If we pray to God, what do I do here, God? God can be part of it, and you may be part of it. The drugs may be part of it. Good nutrition may be part of it. It's all part of it?
Of course, every person, as the scriptures say, must be fully persuaded in their own mind. But God has given us reasoning powers and evidences, and he wants us to weigh out the issues and come to our own conclusion. But what wisdom has he given us? He's given us the wisdom of science. He's given us the wisdom of scripture, and he expects us to use them both. And as I understand James 5:14, where it says, is anyone sick, he should call the elders in the church to pray over him and anoint him with oil in the name of the Lord. Let's discuss what that means after the break.
Let's do that, absolutely. 800-775-4673 is our phone number, 800-775-4673. If you have a question on this very, very important topic today, 800-775-4673. Stay tuned.
Too many Christians don't know the truth about dinosaurs, but Christian scientist Dr. Elaine Graham Kennedy is out to change that. Dr. Kennedy is a research scientist who has done field work at dig sites in remote places like Patagonia. She has spent her life studying dinosaurs, and now she has published a remarkable book called Dinosaurs, published by Pacific Press, that is both scientifically based and biblically sound. It answers the questions many Christians ask. Did dinosaurs really live? Are dinosaur bones fake? Who made the dinosaurs? What happened to them? And were dinosaurs on Noah's Ark? Dr. Kennedy's book, Dinosaurs, is filled with interesting facts, photographs, and colorful charts. It is a must for every Christian home and perfect for reading with your kids. To get a copy, visit www.pacificpress.com or call 1-800-765-6955.
Some important social statements by United States citizens today on policy.
To be a good American, you've got to like people, share things, and not scream at people. And you should also help them, and then you can share at them.
A statement on historical tradition and our form of government.
I love America because it got government full of people and full of people. For the people.
A statement on down-to-earth American idealism.
I like living in America because it means freedom. It means that you can do most stuff you want as long as it doesn't, like, hurt anybody and you have to work hard to keep it.
America, a statement in summary.
I love America because everybody's equal. And when you play with other kids and they dunk you, you can dunk them back.
Welcome back to Simple Solutions. I'm your host, Charles Mills, here along with Christian psychiatrist and author Dr. Timothy Jennings. We're talking about psychiatric medicines today. And Dr. Jennings, you read a text just before the break, James 5:14, where if a person is sick, go see the elders and be anointed with oil. I don't see any psychiatrists in that mix. What's going on?
Well, if you notice what's happening, the scripture's telling you to do both. Pray and do what's medicinally appropriate. Oil in scripture time is not a sacrament. It is a medicinal. When you are wounded, you put oil. And so they're saying, basically, if you're sick, do what's medicinally appropriate and also pray. Don't ignore either side of it. In other words, take your medicine, and pray.
Okay. And today's medicine, you better be praying, because there's a lot of issues on today's medicines. But praying.
Actually, there's a lot of issues. There's a lot of issues on not taking your medicines.
Yes, yes. And that has been shown in the news recently where people did not take their medicines and they literally died. People just, their lives went away. So there's got to be a balance here. And I want to learn that balance from you today, Dr. Jennings, because a lot of our audience, Christians, are thinking, you know, I feel guilty if I do this and I'm not doing it God's way. I'm doing it science way. But you're saying that God is the God of science, and we're missing that, aren't we?
Of course he's the God of science. He created us. He created this incredible machinery, and we are to cooperate with him for the maintenance of our physical body with healthy principles of living, but also because we know going in from birth that we have a physiology that is far from God's original design, and there are all types of environmental exposures we can come across and experiences that can alter us even further, that we should do all within our intelligent power to move ourselves back toward God's original design, the highest state of functioning. If medications can help us achieve that, then we do that. If lifestyle changes can help us achieve that, then we do that. We do whichever is most reasonable and appropriate. But what's foolish is when we say, I will only pray and I won't actually make other types of scientific and physiologic changes that are beneficial to me, even though it could save my life. And of course, we know of situations where people take this to extreme and children have died because parents are refused antibiotics that could save their life and so forth.
Yes, yes, yes. And you tell a story, as a matter of fact, in your book. And I want to remind our listeners that there is an amazing book out there, Could It Be This Simple? You tell the story of about a young lady that came in from an accident that took place and refused treatment for religious purposes, and she died. And you use that story as a wonderful illustration about evidence. But besides the point, you've seen it in action. You've seen it happen when people are actually do harm to themselves by not taking advantage of what God has put in science.
There's no question about it. We have to be reasonable, and it's very sad when people believe distorted beliefs that obstruct the healing remedy from curing them. This is both true on a physiologic level, when people have beliefs about medicines that prevent them from taking them that would get them well, or on a spiritual level, when people have beliefs about God that actually prevent them from experiencing His healing remedy for their souls.
If there's a listener right now who has been diagnosed and has a little cache of medicines that he or she must take from his or her psychiatrist, and things are going along pretty good, should that person say, okay, I'm not done yet, I need to do more here, my job in this world is to get off of these medicines? Should that be the driving force of some people?
Well, no. Our job in this world is to be the healthiest people we can be. And, you know, our show today was to try to educate our audience on some of the mechanisms of how medicines work. But to be balanced, and I want to say that the treatment for mental illnesses includes more than simple medications. Medicines are one piece of a treatment pie. And if you only do medicines and that's all, generally, the outcomes are not robust, or not as robust as they could otherwise be if we did more than medications. In my practice, I include medicines as part of a holistic treatment plan that includes nutritional changes, lifestyle changes such as diet and exercise and removing toxic substances, spiritual evaluation to deal with distorted or unhealthy spiritual activities or God constructs that could be unhealthy, psychological or psychotherapies that improve thinking processes, and science shows that psychotherapies alter brain circuits in healthy ways, that we calm the fear circuits and we improve the functioning of the prefrontal cortex with psychotherapies and family therapies and relational therapies. And so when we look at somebody with a mental illness problem, we want to think holistically and apply a treatment plan that has multiple avenues of improvement to try and bring the entire person back to the healthiest place they can be. Medicines are one very effective and important ingredient in that treatment process, but they should not be considered the exclusive treatment plan. The problem is that there are some groups out there advocating treatments without medicines at all, ever. That is an imbalance in the other way, which actually obstructs people from getting well and living healthy lives.
It must be frustrating to you, Dr. Jennings, to have patients come to you and you prescribe the medicines, as you should, and you also talk to them about how they need to do the faith community, how they need to do their relationships, and you invite them to bring their families and whatnot. You only have control over giving the medicines to them. You can't take them by the hand and drag them off to church. You can't take them by the hand and drag them off to sit down with them and have therapy 24 hours a day. It must be frustrating to you to realize that as much as you understand the overview of the whole thing, you only have control over that small amount. That's got to be frustrating to you.
My recognition, however, in the larger scheme of things, is that God has given us individuality and freedom, and I understand the importance of that in the universe. So I've always been fairly at peace at presenting the truth as I understand it in the most winsome ways possible, and leaving my patients free to make up their own minds when they have the capacity and to make those types of choices. So if a person, and I've tell them, this is your life. If you, metaphorically, if you don't want to brush your teeth and you want your teeth to rot out, you know what? You know, I'll like you just as much, but you're going to be miserable. You're not going to have a good time. I'm not going to lose sleep at night over that. You're going to be in pain. Same thing with your medications. You take your medicines. You don't take your medicines. You quit smoking. You don't quit smoking. You stop doing LSD. You don't stop doing LSD. I mean, anything along these lines, I will guide you and direct you into a path that is going to be most healthy for you. If you choose not to go down that path, it's not going to injure me personally, but it will significantly determine either positive or negative outcomes for your life. And when people start getting their mind around that idea, it often really results in healthier choices. But some make the informed choice, I don't care, I'm going to do this anyway. And they destroy themselves.
Boy, Dr. Jennings, what you just described is exactly God's relationship with us as well. He has the same message to give to us, doesn't he?
It's exactly right. The sad thing is that many people distort God, and so many people who hear the distorted version won't listen to God. They'll send messages like, yes, God loves you. He wants to heal you. He's got a remedy that will cure you, but if you refuse his remedy, well, he'll hunt you down, and he'll torture you, and he'll kill you. Imagine how many doctors would you go see if you actually believed that, well, this doctor's a really, really good doctor, and if you do what he says, he will get you well. But if you ever deviate from what he's telling you to do, he will hunt you down, torture, and kill you. Now, if you believe that about the doctor, would you ever even go see that doctor?
Absolutely not.
Well, this is what most people teach about God. I shouldn't say most, but this is a common teaching about God, and it's very, very distorted, and it's wrong.
Well, you have presented a very balanced view of medicine and faith today. You have presented a wonderful God in what you've said today, Dr. Jennings. We just have a minute or so left. Any final words of wisdom for us?
Yeah, I would tell people when they go, if they're having issues with mental health problems, that they should keep engaged in the conversation, educate themselves the best they can, pursue a holistic approach that includes medications, but not all medications are going to work for every patient. They don't. One patient that may work extremely well for one person may not work at all for another person. And so you should be willing to try more than one. Additionally, not all pharmaceutical regimens are equally beneficial. I frequently have people come see me that are on a particular pharmacy combination that is actually making things worse rather than better. And as we readjust it in a different direction, they can't believe how much better they feel and how much better they're doing. So not all prescribers necessarily are prescribing things that are always beneficial for every particular patient.
Well, all right, listener, you have heard it. You have listened to this. You have asked God to bring it into your heart, and I invite you to digest what Dr. Jennings has said to you today and to apply it to your life. Very, very important information. Dr. Jennings, thank you so much for sharing with us today. We appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And listener, I want you to go to comeandreason.com. Turn on your computer, start your browser, and type in www.comeandreason.com. That's Dr. Jennings' website. You'll find wonderful resources there and articles and discussions, a blog, program archives, resources like his book, Could It Be This Simple? And if you're on Facebook, check us out, Come and Reason. Become a fan, and you'll see wonderful discussions happening there, and it gives you an opportunity to write directly to the good doctor, and I know that he responds with great love and information for you. That's right there on Facebook, Come and Reason. Well, we have spent our time together today. We have our marching orders, and with God's help, we can march wonderfully well toward the kingdom of God in mental and physical health. That's our prayer. Until next week, this is Charles Mills with Dr. Timothy Jennings, inviting you to apply the simple solutions God placed in your heart today. Goodbye, everyone.
Simple Solutions is a production of Life Talk Radio and Dr. Timothy Jennings and is made possible by your generous support. For more information, visit www.comeandreason.com.